Welcome everybody to this interview on Eyes on Investors. And today we're interviewing Daryl Dyke. He's the owner of Noble Mortgage and Investments, and has in the research that I did on you, Daryl, you have a history of what, about 8 years or so investing in real estate. Is that right?
Probably. Well, that actually might be a little bit more. I'm trying to think when I bought my first property. It was probably more. It's probably closer to 12 years now when I actually purchased my first rental property or investment property.
Okay, excellent. So I'm really looking forward to hearing what your experiences have been and everything. Let's start by kind of getting an idea of what you currently own. What's your current portfolio looking like?
Right now I own 8 just single-family rental houses. And they're all leased except for one right now. We just had a vacancy.
Okay. So 8 single-family properties. Are these all in Houston?
Yes, they're all in Houston.
Okay. And your company and your base out of Houston as well, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So these 8 houses that you've got, let's go back and talk about how did you get started in real estate investing?
Well, I got into the mortgage business first off in 1995 as a loan officer for a residential company. And I started investing in real estate when I was approached by a gentleman who actually called me for a loan. He called me and wanted to borrow some money to pay some property taxes on a property, on 3 properties that he had in Spring Branch. And so I was trying to make this gentleman a loan, and he was an older gentleman. He lived a couple hundred miles away, so he was kind of an absentee owner. He had paid property taxes in, I think it was like 8 years or something. A long time. And so I was trying to arrange this guy a loan and just couldn't get him a loan done. And after working with him for a while, so he approached me and said, well, would you like to buy these houses? And at the time, I never really, you know, had experience with purchasing. And so it kind of took me by surprise. But as I looked into it, it looked like, well, maybe this makes some sense, because there were 3 houses. They were all in the same neighborhood. They were all rented. There was a lot of work that needed to be done to him. So that's what really started my career with owning property, was this just a call and trying to get someone a loan. I ended up buying those 3 houses.
I see. So you saw those 3 houses, you looked at them and realized that this was going to be a good purchase for you. What do you remember what the criteria was? Like how did you decide? What were you looking at, I guess, to make that determination where kind of the light went on and said, hey, this would be a good thing to do?
Well, you know, the houses were paid off, except for the taxes of them. So I knew there was some good equity in there. I had some experience in real estate about, you know, what values were, so I looked into the value and so forth, and just kind of went out there to look at them first and saw that there was an opportunity. You know, I saw that this guy was in a distressed situation. He didn't know what to do. He was either going to lose those properties or he had to sell them. And so when I looked at the properties, I mean, they were in pretty rough shape. But I just, something just clicked, and this was probably an opportunity for me to get my foot wet in real estate as far as owning real estate. And we took them on. I took them on, and it was definitely a learning experience after not having to, you know, always making loans on properties but never actually owning them and having to pick them up and deal with tenants. So that's kind of how it started, I guess.
So you were having the experience that your clients had been having. Now you were having that same experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Were you worried about doing the rehab work on those to get them fixed up?
Yeah, I didn't have a lot of experience in fixing properties up, so that was a little bit of concern. But just, you know, tried to get a handle on what needed to be done, immediately on the properties, and get a contractor out there. I mean, I had done some home improvement projects at my own home from a contractor, so I had him come out and just take a look at it, get an estimate. And so it was a little bit, that's probably the most intimidating part for me at the time. So I knew how to do the financing. Leasing them, I wasn't too concerned about, but the rehab was a little bit intimidating for me because I hadn't done a project like this. We've done a remodel on a bathroom on my house, but nothing to the extent of these houses needed.
Do you remember how much it cost you to rehab these properties? It sounds like they were in pretty bad shape.
Yeah, they were pretty banged up. I want to say I spent on each house anywhere from $15,000 to $25,000.
Okay. Yeah, so that was a big project to do.
Yeah, it was a pretty good project. I mean, they were, there were people living in these houses too, which was really concerning. One of them, One of them was a lady with a young daughter, and her window was even busted. You know, didn't have a window at it. So that was another eye-opener, was looking at how these people lived and realizing some people are actually living in these houses. And so I wanted to get them fixed up to make more
things
there and make them happy.
Okay. So when you bought these first three, they already had tenants in them. And but on your other properties, and I'm guessing on those two, you probably had to release them at some point in time. So you've had some experience leasing your properties to people. What kind of, how do you go about leasing properties? What are you looking for? How do you do that?
Well, as far as filling them, it kind of depends on the market. I mean, I have my realtor's license myself as well. I don't use it, I don't go out and list people's properties for sale. I just use it for my own account. So normally my plan of attack is put them on HAR initially to try to get a tenant. Obviously stick a sign in the yard, stick a sign in the neighborhood. Back then we didn't have Craigslist, but I use Craigslist now. But I use Green Sheet quite often to put an ad in there.
Okay.
But those seem to be the techniques. The signs in the yard and the neighborhood always seem to pull the best as people are, in the neighborhood and driving the neighborhood that they want to lease.
Right.
And I just handled it myself. I drew up the lease agreements myself and everything.
Well, that's great. So have you had any tenants that have not worked out? And, like, is there anything you've learned from leasing properties that you can share with us?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have your run-ins, that's for sure. I've been in three houses. I think I lost all three tenants. Because, they were paying very low rents. I didn't want those houses in that condition. After putting a bunch of money in them, I had to raise the rent. And so I think we lost all three tenants. And they really weighed in on their point of view. I've been here for a while. And so we had that this tug of war with, they wanted their rent to stay low. I had to raise it up. So it was definitely an experience to have to deal with them. One thing even got a little bit, I would say hostile, but she was really, really bad.
She didn't want you to raise the rents on her.
Yeah, she didn't want to move. She didn't raise her rent. She had this, one of these entitlement issues where she felt like I was doing her wrong and that I owed her something. And so that was a big experience to go through all that. And, you just got to plug ahead and keep doing what you think you need to do on the property, which is what I did. And we ended up getting new tenants and it worked out fine.
Right. So it's worked out well. So let's talk about the lending environment right now, because in the last probably 2 years or so, things have really changed quite a bit. And in your business, you're making loans to people. Actually, before we talk about the current lending environment, give me a description of what it is that you do day in and day out as you're helping people buy houses.
Well, my company, we're a full-service mortgage company. We specialize in hard money lending, and that's really where my passion is. I've been doing that for a while. But right now, we do hard money loans for investors that are buying and rehabbing single-family or commercial properties. And then we also do conventional financing also for single-family or commercial properties. And so right now the play is, buy and hold because of the way the market is. And so we have programs that enable people to buy properties, to loan the money to buy them, loan the money to do the repairs, and that's through a hard money program. And then once that property has been leased and completed, then we turn around and refinance it on a regular 30-year mortgage at a market rate, which is about 5.5% right now. So it's a two-step process.
Okay.
Most of our lending is involved right now, whereas a few years ago, it was a lot more people flipping properties. Now it's mostly people that are buying and holding.
Buying and holding, okay. So let's talk about how the lending market has changed. The market, too, has changed, as you mentioned. A few years ago, people were flipping more. Now they're buying and holding. So what have you changed? How can people – I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. So what is it that you see has changed in the market and in the lending environment?
Well, everything's changed in the lending environment. Matter of fact, I was at a mortgage broker at luncheon last week, and the lady that was leading the talk, she said, since the credit crisis, there has been over 4,000 changes in the mortgage industry, regulatory and legal changes.
Wow, and that's in, about a year and a half or so?
That's about 3 years.
Or 3 years?
Started in 2007 is kind of where the crisis started. So you know, when investors get frustrated with, they hear that mortgage people are telling them, oh, there's been so many changes. I mean, think about it, in 3 years, over 4,000 changes. That's a lot.
That is a lot.
I mean, so everything has changed, and it's not done changing yet. So, you know, before, it was very, very easy to get a loan, regardless of your credit, regardless if you had income, regardless if you had assets, all those sorts of things. And now it's completely opposite. Now you have to have excellent credit. You have to have reserves in the bank. You have to qualify for a debt to income ratio. And before there was programs both, and now it's you have credit, income, and assets on the conventional market. And I'm not talking about the hard money.
Right.
Market, or you just can't get a loan. So if you're looking to buy and hold, you've got to have strong credit, or you're just not going to get a loan right now. So it's completely different, and they're not done changing. There's more changes coming.
Right. So with hard money loans, you can make your own underwriting requirements, but because you're converting those into conventional loans, then you do need to qualify buyers to make sure they'll be able to get a conventional loan. Is that right?
That's right. And the way we look at it is, when we talk to someone who wants to purchase a property, if they want a hard money loan, our first question is, what's your exit strategy? If your exit strategy is to refinance that property and hold it long term, then they have to be able to qualify for that conventional loan. If their exit strategy is just simply to sell it, then they don't have to qualify for a long term loan.
I see.
We still want to make sure they have some cash reserves to make sure they can pay the loan and so forth. Obviously, we're going to look at the property and make sure that it's in a marketable condition, to make sure that it's in a marketable area. But qualifying for a long-term loan is not important because the exit strategy is simply to sell it. Because the hard money loans are not made to be a long-term loan. It's made to be a short-term loan.
Okay, and the interest rates are higher on these hard money loans because of... And that's part of the way that they work as well, right?
Yeah, on a hard money loan, you can expect to pay a double-digit interest rate, typically anywhere from 12 to 18%, depending on the lender. And we're at the low end of that. We charge typically 12% to, especially with our lifestyle investors, we can put 12% to them on.
Right, okay. So what would you recommend for somebody who is just getting started in real estate, say they don't have any experience because they haven't purchased any houses yet, they have credit that's pretty good, they've got some cash reserves in the bank, what do you recommend to them as far as getting started and getting their financing lined up?
Well, getting pre-approved is step one. I mean, right now, you can't even put an offer out on a piece of property without being pre-approved by a mortgage lender. So the first thing I would do is seek out a mortgage lender who can pre-approve you for a loan and make sure they'll give you an idea of how much you can borrow, what the payment's going to be, how much down payment you're going to need, so they have all that in order. And then when they get a pre-approval letter, then they're ready and armed and ready to go out and start making offers on properties. Because most sellers these days, because the credit crunch is so tight, they won't even accept an offer unless they have a pre-approved buyer.
Right. Okay, so step one is go get pre-approved, which means go talk to a lender such as yourself or another company where you will kind of check them out. You'll pull a credit report on them, look at their assets and liabilities, kind of their whole financial picture, and then you'll let them know if they're going to be able to qualify for a loan or not.
That's correct.
Okay.
I mean, they've got to get pre-approved, but that was step one. And then, you know, after that, they obviously need to get with a realtor or realtors that they're comfortable with and come up with a strategy as to where they want to buy. They really need to hone in and dial in on exactly what they want, as opposed to just going out there and using a shotgun approach. They need to narrow down what part of town they want to be in. They need to narrow down what price range they want to be in, how many, bedrooms and baths, how much they expect to rent that property for. You know, they got to really kind of scale it down to figure out exactly what their strategy is going to be. But the more precise they can be, the more successful they're going to be, especially with staying in the same part of town, somewhere close to your house. If you're having to go look at these properties, check on them from time to time. If you live in Katy, even if I want to drive to Baytown all the time looking at them. So some of the more successful investors that we've seen, especially as of late, have really honed that down. And they buy in generally the same area. They generally buy the same type of property, and they've got a system there. And even when they're first-time investors, for that first property, before you know it, they're 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 into it because they've really honed down and got the experience to figure out what
right.
they're doing.
Yeah, you know, that's a recurring theme that the successful investors that I've been talking to and doing interviews with, I've heard that almost everybody has recommended that, just as you are, to make sure you hone into an area that's close to where you are, understand that area inside and out, create systems so that you can just kind of repeat what works, and it's very good advice. Yeah, I hope people listening really take that to heart.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense because, again, you don't want to drive all the way across town and advertise them to have to go do something on the property if it comes up. Because if that happens, then initially you might be, you know, willing to do that when you're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, but a couple years down the road, you know, you're going to start putting it off more and more and more because the property's far away, and then you become an absent owner. You don't want to be an absent owner with a rental house because it'll go away from you quickly.
Right. Yeah, in fact, I was talking to somebody a couple weeks ago that has a house in Katy, and they live on the east side of Houston. It's about a 45, 50-minute drive for them to get out to Katy, which is actually where I am, and they were interested in selling the house. It's a rental property because they're just tired of driving over there. You know, even if it's only every couple months, it's just a big hassle to go over there. And they were actually in between tenants, so they were releasing their property. And they're like, I think we just want to sell this instead of go, you know, release it. It's just too much work to just do all this driving around.
Yeah, it'll wear you out. I mean, you know, we have experience with that when we have foreclosures. You know, because when we lend our own money out on the hard money basis, you know, we'll get a foreclosure every once in a while, and we'll lend anywhere from Houston to Austin to Dallas to San Antonio. And, you know, at one point during 2008, when we had a handful of foreclosures, I had one in Baytown, I had one in Angleton, and one in Austin. And you know, I'm driving all
around.
You know, and I go check on them all the time, and it wears you out.
Yeah. So when somebody gets a hard money loan, how long do they usually have that loan before it converts into a conventional mortgage?
Anywhere from 3 to 6 months, kind of depends. We always tell everybody 6 months just to be conservative, but we've been successful at getting them out as quick as 3 months.
Okay. So I haven't done a hard money loan personally. I've either done conventional or cash purchases, but I know a lot of people are doing hard money loans now. And one of the questions that I get asked is, well, what happens if I can't get a conventional loan? What happens if I get stuck in the hard money loan? So have you actually had any customers or clients have that happen to them?
We have not, no, because we qualify them up front. So, again, the first question we ask is, what is your exit strategy? And if the answer is, well, we're going to refinance it and we want to hold it long-term as a rental property, then we qualify for that loan up front to make sure that they got the credit, they got the debt-to-income ratio, they got the assets, and so forth. We don't close that hard money loan unless we know we can get a loan.
Okay.
We've never had an issue with being stuck with someone who just could not get them a loan.
Right.
I suppose it could happen, you know, if you're in an environment like where I'm now with it. You know, the regulations are constantly changing, but we've never had it happen here, thank goodness. But most of the time, when someone has good enough credit financials and qualified, you can always find them a loan.
Then it'll be okay. So that's really the key, is having solid financials and good credit.
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
You can qualify up front before you do the hard money loan, as opposed to later.
Right. So you won't do the initial hard money loan unless you have a really good sense by looking at the data that they're going to qualify for the conventional and you haven't had a problem with that.
That's right, yeah. I mean, we qualify them exactly as if we were just doing a conventional loan for them right then.
Right.
Provided they qualify for that conventional loan, then we'll close that hard money loan for them up front. And then again, of course, unless they're planning on selling them, then we don't really care with them.
Okay. And I think you kind of addressed this in what you were saying, but I wanted to ask, with all of the regulations and how they keep changing, what's the risk that during, say, that 3 to 6 month period of time, from when you get the hard money to when you actually do the refinance to conventional, that some of the rules change and that, I know you haven't had this experience, but what do you feel like is the risk there that could happen?
Well, the risk... You know, there is a risk there if something drastically changes on with Fannie Mae and how they underwrite or how they, you know, how many properties you own. That was an issue a couple of years ago.
They went from like 10 to 4 or something like that?
10 to 4 and then now it's back to 10.
Okay.
So if they were to go back to 4, would that be an issue? I mean, yes and no. If someone qualifies for a Fannie Mae loan right now, and a couple months down the road they want to refi, and some reason Fannie Mae says, oh, you've got too many properties, you're not going to do this now. There are other sources of lending out there. It's not going to be a Fannie Mae loan. It may not be quite as good of a loan as a Fannie Mae. So, you know, a Fannie Mae loan is right now 30-year fixed at 5.5%.
Okay.
If that's not available, there are other sources of what we call portfolio lenders, but it may be a 20-year amortization and maybe more like a 6.5-7% rate.
I see.
It's still going to be a lot better than where you're at on the hard money, so there are other sources.
Okay, that makes sense. So really what we're talking about is the risk of being stuck in a hard money loan is really pretty low, because even if things drastically change, there's still going to be other ways to get the conventional financing, even if it's not through a Fannie Mae type scenario. It may cost a little bit more and not be quite as ideal, but it'll still be better than being stuck in a hard money loan.
Yeah. I mean, there's other sources, and we're starting to see the market loosen up a little bit, not a lot, but it's starting to thaw a little bit, if you will. And so, and even when you get over 10 properties, we use portfolio lenders now all the time for people that have, they already have 10 properties and Fannie Mae won't lend to them. So we go to our portfolio lenders, and so you have to make sure you align yourself with the mortgage lender or mortgage broker who has other contacts besides just strictly that Fannie Mae.
Okay. So what is a portfolio lender for people that aren't familiar with that term?
A portfolio lender is really just a bank. It's a bank loan that's going to hold that loan in the portfolio as opposed to securitize it and sell it. So when you make a Fannie Mae loan, you're going through a lender that makes a loan and they immediately want to sell it off in the secondary market and make more loans. A portfolio lender is going to make that loan and keep that loan in-house and service it throughout the life. It could get sold later, but normally they're held.
Okay. And they don't, a portfolio lender won't necessarily have a cap or a limit on how many investment properties you can own or how many you can borrow money on. Am I understanding that right?
Correct. And not typically. I've never seen a portfolio lender have a cap, but they will, you know, depending on the borrower. They're going to look at the strength of the borrower to determine how many properties or how many loans they want to have with them.
Okay.
And some of these lenders, and all these portfolio lenders also have a lending limit to one borrower, so they may have a $2 million lending limit to any one borrower. So that's kind of a cap. But again, it kind of depends on the borrower, you know, how much money they have in the bank, their income. So it's different. Whereas with Fannie Mae, it's pretty much a box you have to fit into. With a portfolio lender, it's going to be different from lender to lender.
I see. Okay. So one more question on this lending thing. This is kind of a personal one because I'm going through an experience right now where I'm purchasing a Bank of America-owned foreclosure, and I'm actually getting my loan through Bank of America. It's a conventional 30-year fixed mortgage. And they accepted my offer, what's today, Thursday. I think they accepted my offer on Tuesday. But when I was working with the lender to do all the financials and he wanted to pre-qualify me, I own two other rental properties. And he said that my income-to-debt ratio was kind of skewed. And what I found out is that they weren't counting the income that I have from my rental properties. So I own, you know, probably about, or I owe about $100,000 in, you know, with mortgages on these other two properties. And they were counting that against my income, but not including the rental income as part of my income. And so I have some other income beyond just my standard basic stuff, and we had to throw those in there to make the ratios work. But I'm wondering, for other people, is that an issue that sometimes they're going to run across if they have multiple investment properties, that the lender may not count their rental income as income against their debt to, you know, lending ratio?
Well, no, that you should be able to count your rental income, but it also depends on how you report, and that's another thing that's changed with how their loans are underwritten. So before the current credit crunch that we're in, if you had a property and it was rented for $1,200, you could list $1,200 as what you're getting for that rent, and they would count a percentage of that towards your income. Now what they do is they actually look at your tax return. So if you're reporting $1,200 a month, and at the end of the year you had expenses of repairs for whatever it was, $5,000, intro to this, they actually look at how you report it on your Schedule B.
I see.
A lot of investors, what they do is they write off everything. And so they've got this rental property, and after all their expenses that they put in there on their tax return, it looks like they're not making any money, and it's actually costing them. So that's kind of the pitfall that a lot of investors are running.
Okay. Okay, that makes sense. So depending on how you report the income on your taxes and your expenses too could impact whether it's getting counted as income or not.
Right.
Gotcha.
If you don't count income on your tax returns, then you're not going to count it as income.
Right.
Long.
Okay. All right.
A lot of people are running into that because, you know, a lot of investors simply write off as much as they can. And on black and white, it doesn't look good, even if they actually may be a proper investment.
Right, that makes sense. Okay. All right, well, this has been really interesting, Daryl, and I appreciate your time today in talking about your investments and talking about financing. I think people are going to find this very, very helpful. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you feel like people should know about that that you can share with them?
You know, the only thing I would say for first-time investors is do what we talked about and only get pre-approved to find a good real estate you can work with. Hone in on what it is you want to do, but also be realistic. You know, there's a lot of eager doers out there that want to get into the market. The real estate market is great; it's a great business. But you know, make some realistic goals as to what you want to accomplish. You know, we get calls from people that say, "Oh, I want to start buying eight houses a month starting next month." It's not a realistic goal. You know, take it one step at a time. Get your traction underneath you before you go out there guns blazing trying to conquer the world in a day. You know. So that I would just say be realistic and also on your value when you're estimating what the home's going to rent for, what you think the value's on. Don't just look at the top of the market. Look at the whole scheme and make sure you know what you're doing. And a good realtor can shed a lot of light on that as well.
Right. Okay. So get a good realtor, get a good lender, ask the right questions, and be realistic. And you're not going to be able to go out and conquer the world in one day.
No. Woman
today. That's right. Well, thank you again, Daryl. Really appreciate it. And I will. It'll probably take about a week or so to get our interview transcribed, and I'll let you know once it's up there and available. And I think we'll have lots of people watching it. And again, thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Dan.
Take care.
Bye-bye.